Thomas Bernard.
I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Bruce McDermott. I speak here on behalf of the appellants.
Counsel, I have some questions that I'd like to focus on.
Absolutely.
As you start to talk. First question I have is this. This apparently is a large estate, at least from the record. Do you have an estimate of how large a trust estate we're dealing with here?
Boy.
Yes or no? I mean,
the PR, who I think is actually in the audience, might be able to tell us.
Okay.
It's subject to several obligations. So what the net value of the estate is, I'm not sure at this
point. Okay. At minimum, it's large.
It's pretty large.
Okay. So in the context of the competing contingent beneficiaries, it makes a difference that one set has a $20,000 max recovery and the other set has a percentage of the estate.
I'm so informed, Your Honor.
Okay. The next question or series of questions I have is with respect to the packet of documents that the bailiff handed you.
Yes, I have it.
You have that?
Yes.
And opposing counsel apparently also has it.
So I understand.
The top page of that collection of documents has the signature page of Mr. Bernard, Tom Bernard's March 25th, 2009 will. Do you see where I'm referring to?
I do.
I guess it's Article 3.5 says, among other things, it's captioned binding non-judicial agreement, and it says this will is subject to that certain non-judicial agreement, et cetera, of even date. Do you see where I'm referring to?
I do.
Do you agree that the term subject to has a legal meaning?
A legal meaning?
Well, I don't want to hide the ball. Do you believe that subject to means contingent on or words to that effect?
It means related to. It doesn't mean incorporated.
Okay.
That was the point of our briefing.
Okay. Right. Now, one of the issues that we have to address is the relationship between the non-judicial binding agreements and the other testamentary documents.
That's true.
In this connection, with respect to the language in the will, it only says that the will is subject to that non-judicial binding agreement. And as you pointed out a moment ago, there's no reference to incorporation in this document, correct?
That is correct.
All right. Now, if you turn the page, the clerk's paper is 207. It appears to be a copy, unsigned copy of the trust, and I take it that this is in fact an accurate representation of the March 25th, 2009 trust of Mr. Bernard. Do you have any reason to believe that it is not?
I do not.
Okay. Under Article 3.1 of that document, near the bottom of the page, it said that he reserved the right, sub B, to modify this instrument being the trust, correct?
Correct.
Okay. If you turn the page and look at Article 3.2, effectiveness, it says that any modification, and I'm leaving out some of the words, any modification shall be valid and fully effective whenever trustees shall receive from trustor written notice thereof. You see where I'm reading?
I do.
There does not appear to be any dispute that in this particular case the trustees receive such written notice.
That is correct.
Okay, so that particular article is not really at issue here.
Correct.
If we go to paragraph or Article 3.3, it talks about rights personal to trustor subject to binding nonjudicial agreement.
Yes.
The second sentence of that paragraph says, notwithstanding any other provision of this agreement, such, and I'll insert the word, modification rights are subject to, again, we have that word, subject to that certain non-judicial agreement regarding Mr. Bernard of even date. I take it that the meaning of subject to is probably the same here as it was in the will that we just discussed?
Likely, since it was drafted by the same person.
Okay. The next sentence says, if and to the extent such TEDRA, and I think we're talking about the March 25th TEDRA, is determined to be unenforceable for any reason, the restrictions on trustor's right to, among other things, modify this trust shall be incorporated in this agreement. Now, we have that word incorporated here.
Yes, we do.
And I take it that incorporation is something different from subject to for purposes of your argument.
Yes, that's correct.
So I take it that your argument here is that shall be incorporated is conditional. Conditional on the March agreement being found to be unenforceable.
That's right.
In this case, that March agreement has never been determined to be unenforceable, correct?
That is also correct.
So incorporation under the plain words of this paragraph never occurred.
That is true.
Okay. Now, the trial court here seemed to be concerned in his oral decision over the lack of some kind of a court order that preceded the non-judicial agreement of August 27th, 2009, correct?
That is correct.
If, in fact, that agreement properly modified the March non-binding agreement, and if, in fact, there was a filing of a memorandum of that August 27, 2009 agreement, doesn't the statute by operation of law make that agreement equivalent to a court order?
It does.
So why is there a problem with the absence of a court order prior to that time?
There is no such, no problem.
Okay. Let me ask you two other questions. I don't want to eat up all your time.
Okay.
It's my understanding that the capacity of Mr. Bernard was not decided by the court and is not before us.
That is correct, or undue influence.
Okay, so that's my last question. Thanks.
Okay. Okay, so with a minute left, let me say just briefly, the two issues that are very important to the estate planning community here are as follows. Number one, as a practical matter, can a TEDRA agreement modify another TEDRA agreement under the statute? It is certainly the practice, as the papers reveal, of this community, that the answer to that question is yes. Secondly, can a trustator, testator's fundamental right to decide what happens to his property upon death be abrogated by a technical argument such as the ones that are being made here? And the Elliott case is quite clear and has been followed since that the answer to that question is no. So we believe the appropriate action here by this court is to reverse, remand, and allow for trial under the proper burden of clear, cogent, and convincing evidence whether, in fact, the testator lacked, Tom Bernard lacked capacity or was being unduly influenced. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have 2 minutes for
good morning. If it please the court, my name is Christopher Lee of Helsel Fetterman on behalf of respondents Rick Emery, Larry Emery, and Rose Linger.
How large is the estate, if you know?
I don't know. I don't believe it's as large as the beneficiaries hope, but I would say it's in excess of $1 million, but I'm not sure if it's necessarily significantly in excess of that amount.
Okay. I could ask you the same series of questions that I ask your opposing counsel, but maybe I should shorten it up by saying, do you have any reason to believe that the non-judicial agreement of March 25th, 2009 was incorporated into the trust that then existed?
I do believe it was incorporated into the trust.
Why?
Because the fact is that you have to take reasonable interpretations and inferences from the events to the and the provision reads, if and to the extent such tether is determined to be unenforceable for any reason. Now, the amendment of, the attempted amendment of that agreement is in a way of making that agreement unenforceable.
The trial court never ruled on the enforceability of the marched agreement.
No, but then you're reading into that, that when it says determined to be, that it requires an actual judicial ruling on that.
I'm not reading anything into the document. I'm reading the plain language of the document. And it appears to me there's never been a fulfillment of the condition that the March 25th, 2009 agreement was deemed to be unenforceable.
Well, I think the fact of it having not been followed at all points to the fact that the appellants feel that it is unenforceable, and they feel that Tom Bernard felt it was unenforceable.
Who does the TEDRA contemplate would make a determination of unenforceability?
With regards to the determination of unenforceability, I think the TEDRA agreement looks to the fact that if you're not following the provisions which are required, then it is by operation not being enforced. So to the extent that you've got the word determined to be unenforceable, you can I believe it stands to reason that if you're not following it, you're not enforcing
it. The phrase not being enforced and unenforceable are synonymous.
For the operation of the trust, yes. Because you have to look at what the trust is wanting and the trust is intending. So there's a lot of discussion, and I'm not saying that the appellants are wrong in the statement that the last testamentary intent is important. But all the case law says to the extent that it is expressed in conformance with the law. To look at the intent, we have to look at the documents. We determine the intent from the document. We have in 3.3 this very specifically written paragraph that says, you need to follow subject to these modification provisions. And then in the event that it's determined to be unenforceable, it's going to be incorporated such that it shall be in this document.
Let me ask you some questions about the following of the procedures. I take it your position, or at least in the briefing, is that the procedures of the March agreement were not followed, correct?
Absolutely, Your
Honor. Okay. Now, those procedures included, among other things, a petition setting out
one. Noticed hearing, yes, Your Honor.
And a hearing.
Yes.
And an order.
Yes, Your Honor.
Here we have a situation where Mr. Bernard and his son signed an agreement.
Yes, Your Honor.
That the trust would be modified in certain ways. Why was the hearing necessary under those circumstances?
Well, first, and this is the point that the trial court made, once you take a memorandum from a TEDRA agreement and file it with the court, you're asking the court that we want this to be a court order, equivalent to a court order.
You're not asking the court to do anything. By operation of the law,
by operation of the
statute says that by filing,
right,
it's equivalent to a court
exactly.
order.
Exactly. So now there is a court order out there that says, if you want to exercise the modification powers, these are the steps you have to take. And at the very end it says, if you don't follow these steps and first obtain the court order, then the modification shall be null and void.
But you're not answering my question. My question
is,
if parties stipulate to a result, why does one need a hearing? It seems one of the purposes of TEDRA is to make things simpler and less expensive. If the parties to the agreement agree to a resolution, why is a petition necessary? Why is a summons necessary? Why is a hearing even necessary for purposes of complying with the provisions of the March agreement?
And to the extent if all of the parties, all of the interested parties, as TEDRA requires, were parties to the August agreement, I would agree with that. But
why weren't all the parties?
Because the only people who signed off on the August TEDRA agreement were Tom Bernard and his son Jimmy Bernard.
Well, that's your argument, that somehow you're entitled to be a party to the agreement you weren't a party to originally.
Right, because the trust was created at the time of the original March TEDRA. Prior to that, there was no trust. So by contemporaneous execution of the trust document and the Tedra agreement, they created a trust which now had other interested parties to it. For example, new interested parties to the trust are the trustees. They are parties clearly under the definitional section of Tedra. Nelson versus Griffith, 11106040, all point to the fact that remainder contingent beneficiaries are beneficiaries under Tedra. 11106040 specifically states that such beneficiaries can bring a petition under Tedra for an accounting. So when that trust was created, a whole group of interested parties were created. That included my three clients and included the eight or so charitable beneficiaries who now had, as Nelson Griffith said, we don't care whether you call it a contingent interest or a remainder interest, a beneficiary is a beneficiary of a trust. And to the extent that there's mandates in the trust that would act in benefit for subsequent beneficiaries, those beneficiaries have rights under the trust and are interested parties. So when you are going to change that document, and significantly change the document, especially on behalf of my clients, it stands to reason that they should receive notice of that change so they can have an opportunity to comment.
What argument could they possibly make as long as Mr. Bernard's son's still alive?
Well, for the exact same reasons that the way the provisions are written in the modification orders. The first one isn't, hey, just have a hearing. It's have a hearing and clearly and precisely state to the court
describe
what the purpose
is. Describe for me a potentially meritorious argument that your clients could make if Mr. Bernard's son was still alive at the time of the hearing and his death wasn't imminent.
To the extent of meritorious argument with regards to what, that they required notice?
Objection to the agreement that father and son were making. But what possible objection could they make that would have any colorful merit as long as the son's death wasn't imminent?
With respect to the March 2009 agreement,
no,
there
the
would
last
be...
last agreement.
The August agreement? The colorful argument they have is that the way that it's been positioned is somehow my clients and the charitable beneficiaries are preceding or following the interest of Jamie. They're not. They stand next to each other. If Jamie's alive, Jamie gets, and then there's no follow-through that if he should die subsequently, anything goes to my client.
You're not answering my question.
Well, I'm trying to set up the factual pattern.
We've only got a minute 13, so
okay.
Better hurry.
Well, the fact is that case law holds, Nelson versus Griffiths hold, that they have a beneficial interest. If this court is saying that it's stating new law that contingent beneficiaries don't have a beneficial interest such that they receive notice.
That's not my question to you. My question is, what would they say to the judge at the hearing as a reason why the son and the father couldn't make the agreement they were making?
The father doesn't have capacity to do so. He's subject to undue influence.
And you get that argument still available to you if we remand as requested by appellant. So you haven't lost anything there.
And then the court would be abrogating case law with regards to the modification of trust and the fact that they need to be substantially complied with by their own terms. This is not merely
So you're going to make a technical argument that both the actual beneficiary who's alive and the testator, trustor, can't do what they want to do because of some technicality or hoop they have.
Oh, no, not some technicality. This is something that they did themselves. They made an agreement which very specifically set forth modification restrictions.
If parties to a contract that requires some form for modification can always agree to change that specific term of the contract.
It becomes more than just a contract once you incorporate Tedra. Once you incorporate Tedra, you are now involving the court's jurisdiction. As the trial court said, once you invoke the jurisdiction and authority of the court.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Your Honors, I'll be brief and sort of seriatim here. Bang, bang, bang. First of all, Nelson v. Griffiths was an irrevocable trust case. There's a big difference between a revocable trust and an irrevocable trust. Nelson itself says that they became beneficiaries when the testator or the trustor died. So it's inapplicable here. Number two, as we discuss in the brief at 16 to 21, none of the Tedra requirements for standing are met here on the part of the Linger parties. If James had died and Tom wanted to change his will, would the Linger parties have any standing to do anything? The answer is, of course not. The three-step process involved notice to James. James would be dead. The Linger parties are just like any set of contingent beneficiaries. They either win or they lose, depending on what the testator wanted. And it's the testator's intent that this court should keep its eye on as the polar star, as the Elliott Court said, of its inquiry. What did the last legitimate intent of the testator, what was it? And to every extent possible, to allow it to be upheld. That doesn't mean the court can end this case, but it does mean the court should send it back so we can determine whether the other challenges on the appropriate burden of proof are met, because we haven't had a chance to do that, notwithstanding several pages on that issue in respondent's brief. Thank you very much.